Greetings, couch potatoes across the country, around the world, and on the internet. I'm Kevin Carr.
And I'm Cole Bias, and you're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies.
That's right. I noticed you took off doctor. Are you no longer a doctor? Did you get stripped of your film doctorate license?
No, I did that a long time ago, and I never had a film doctorate. It was actually more of a tractor repair doctorate, and I didn't think it appropriate. It's sort of like Dr. Laura, you know, when you get like a doctorate in nutrition or like dog tooth studies or whatever she has a doctorate in, it just seems not applicable to what you're actually working on, and it can be misleading. So I dropped that about a year and a half ago, and the hate mail has stopped.
I refuse to drop it.
Thank you.
I'm going to keep this going on. I'm going to make it live.
Well, you know, over at FSR, Landon Palmer will have his PhD in film studies in about 1.5 or 2 years. So you'll have someone else to kick around as a doctor.
Is he going to change his Twitter handle to The Real Doctor?
Yeah, I hope so. I actually hope so. But either that or I'm not sure if he will lose any sort of prestige by adding PhD on the end of him.
Can I start referring to you as Cole Bias Esquire?
That's fine, too. That's technically meaningless in the United States. But if we're in Britain, then I would actually... You could be arrested for pretending to be a barrister. Yeah, because here it means nothing. We don't actually use Esquire on anything. But in Britain, Esquire, it means very specifically that you're a barrister. So here we don't really do that. But, you know, I have a question for you. How do people get a hold of you?
Oh, my God. Well, you mean on... For the show or just in general?
No,
people
just
can
come
up and grab me.
I just mean, what is your preferred hug method?
Oh, I didn't know if people just start grabbing random body parts when they see me on the street, which is okay. That's fine. You can do that. I approve of that.
Yes.
But no, you can reach us at fatguysofthemovies.com. You can go to iTunes and search Fat Guys of the Movies, and we pop right up. You can go to Fat Guys Network as well on iTunes and get all the shows that we've got. You can go to facebook.com/FGATM, like our page. And, you know, I don't know if you can poke a page. Can you poke a page?
I think you can. I think actually if you poke Kevin in real life, he'll pop up too.
I do encourage people to poke me. Just randomly come up and poke me. Especially if you're cute.
And then run away.
And run away and giggle and wave your arms like you're, you know, run like a girl from an 80s movie.
Or like Kermit the Frog has just been surprised.
We can also email us at fatguys@filmschoolrejects.com. We got a couple of those that we're going to read in the middle segment. You can leave us a voicemail at 740-205-6456. So far, we're just getting creditor calls and we don't return those.
I think you should totally do some voicemail on the show recordings from people that are like, are you happy with your credit limit right now?
What are the people going, we're trying to reach Kevin Carr. He's got an outstanding payment on his, on his car loan. I don't answer those on my real phone.
Yeah.
So, anyways, so what's going on, Dr. Cole?
You know, actually, well, it's funny you should ask. I really need to apologize to everyone listening and who downloaded and listened to the Reject Radio podcast on Wednesday that we did, because my voice is gone, as you may be able to hear. I work at a haunted house here in Tucson, Arizona, called the Slaughterhouse, and it's in an old abandoned slaughterhouse, as you might think, and there's like 5 haunts, and it's huge. It's like 90,000 square feet. And,
wouldn't it be better if it was a real operating slaughterhouse? That would be way scarier.
I think there would be fewer injuries, but we actually did. One of our haunts was the concept was what it would be like to go through a slaughterhouse, the process. And we actually, the corral is still up in the yard. This huge corral where, you know, millions of cows probably went through on their way to meet their maker.
And you walking all over millions of cows.
Yeah, that's poo-poo. Exactly true. And we would walk people in, and they would go through the you know, the auctioneer site. They would go through the kill room and the deboning room and the butcher rooms, and then they go through the oven and into the cafeteria and into the test kitchen. So we kind of did, you know, in the entire process. And I begged them at least one night to have someone at the exit of that haunt to just be out there with a big old barbecue handing out free hamburgers.
That'd be awesome. But did you have Javier Bardem shooting people in the head with the kill gun?
We actually, in the kill room, we did have a gun that made a really loud noise. And right outside in the hallway, we had someone posted up with what is really, I guess it's really a tile, like not a jackhammer, but it's air-powered tiling gun. and it makes a really creepy noise, and it's loud and scary. So we use that, and we use a lot of other stuff. So, but my voice officially gone from screaming at young children and making older men wet themselves. So
you, my wife's a teacher. She does the exact same thing
on a daily basis. See, and her voice is fine. So I'm just weak. Used to it. I'm weak.
How much did it cost to go to your Slaughter Haunted House?
It was $20 a ticket, which is
expensive now.
It's one of the cheaper ones actually now.
Really?
It's middle price. There are some of the 30
and 40. Did they have the thing where you can jump the line for 30?
Oh, ours was like a VIP for 50, but you got t-shirts and t-shirts and hats, and you got to jump the line. So,
and you got to disembowel a cow while you were there.
Yeah,
too.
And we have people like, you know, in costume wandering around their yard, and we have 5 haunts, so it was pretty, you know, it's a bigger deal. But there's actually one. Speaking of which, though, that you would like that the Vortex Theater in New York City puts on. That's an adult only haunted house. Ooh.
It's, what pokes out at you at that one?
All right, you have to go in alone. You have to sign a big waiver that says you'll go in alone, and they can actually touch you. We can't. We don't. Our actors don't touch you at all. But they actually, you sign something.
Anything adult related, I don't go to unless they're allowed to touch me.
Well,
that's all there is to it.
Apparently, they remove a piece of clothing and they give it back to you later. But there's full frontal nudity, both male and female, and so wow. It's a special. Now, it just screamed Kevin Carr to me.
I may have to check this one out next time in New York. I'll have to go to New York City just to go to this. So now that it's Christmas time, or you know, because technically Christmas season starts after Halloween.
That's true.
Are you going to call it the Laughter House now?
That's exactly what we've been joking about, calling it the Laughter House. I actually want to do a like frightening Santa Claus themed haunt in next October, where it's like the North Pole, but it's ravaged by elves that have big, sharp, pointed teeth, and a Santa that's like the Devil Santa or something. That would just be like Santa's sleigh, I guess. SLAY.
That would be great, yeah.
But I have no idea what they're gonna do. I think there's a rave there this weekend. They actually bought the building, and they'll probably be using it year round for teen club hangout nights and concerts and whatnot. But overall, I don't care about that stuff. I just care about scaring people. So.
Raves and old slaughterhouses, that just cannot be hygienic.
I like it. I like it a lot. And speaking of which, I don't even know if we're going off on tangents or anything, but since since we're talking about it, I found out, since we're talking about doing security for this rave, I found out that kids today, like back, you know, when you and your generation, and even my generation, were smoking pot, like responsible people, apparently the kids of today are actually loading up drugs in enema bags. And giving each other enemas. This is a true thing. This is a thing that happens.
That's wonderful. No. What? I don't even know how to respond to that. You know how I'm going to respond to that? I'm going to talk about Tower Heist. Let's introduce this. We'll get into the break and we'll review it on the other end.
Best unintentional segue.
We need to do that, yes. A group of workers from the 99% try to steal a cache of $20 million from a 1%er who embezzled their pensions.
Tower Heist.
Just an hour ago, the tower's richest resident was released into federal custody under house arrest here at his penthouse apartment.
Several years ago, he was asked to manage all of your pensions. Right now, they're saying that anyone who invested with Mr. Shaw has been defrauded.
Did he get your money, too?
Yeah.
All these guys keep cash close by, but we still haven't found Shaw's safety net. 20 million and change.
So you're saying you want to rob Arthur Shaw? It's inside a building that has the most advanced security and is guarded by FBI agents 24 hours a day.
And welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies. I am Cola Bias, guest starring today, guest hosting. Guest starring hosting. Seems like I have a big ego, but
starring is, and there's no stars on this.
I am starring in the show, and Kevin is an extra this week. Right. We're going to be reviewing two films, both of which that I haven't seen. So I'm just going to be asking Kevin pointed questions about them. Tower Heist and A Very Harold and Kumar 3D Christmas. So, Kevin, why don't you take it away and get us started on either one that you want to start with?
Well, Tower Heist, because we just heard the trailer for that going into the break. So this one is the latest from Brett Ratner, which stars Ben Stiller and Eddie Murphy and Casey Affleck and Gabby Sabidi.
And a lot of checks in the mail.
Yes. And Alan Alda. Now here's the thing. I was talking on the break that I actually like Brett Ratner. Against all better judgment, I enjoy his films.
You use the word like instead of love or love. Really enjoy.
Well, but here's the thing, and this is the thing with Brett Ratner. In general, I've enjoyed his movies. I can't point to a movie that I'm like, oh my God, that was so awful, I would never watch it again. Whereas somebody like Ron Howard, I think, is a fantastic director, but then you have these movies like The Missing, that sort of, or The Grinch, and you're just like, well, those are so awful. But, movies like Backdraft and Far and Away are fantastic films,
No, absolutely. And that's, Brett Ratner is middling. He is right down the middle. And I
consistently
too,
so.
I, too, don't share the ire that a lot of people had for the third X-Men film.
Yeah.
I thought it was not nearly as good as the first two, but it was still a fun movie in its own way. Mm-hmm. Like, there was good things about it, and Brett Ratner certainly didn't rape it up against a pinball machine like some people seem to think. But can we say that on the air?
Is probably not in Wyoming, so we may have to take out that accused reference, but that's okay. I'll bleep it
out. Sorry, Wyoming. It's going to be worse with the bleep, though, because it's just going to be like, he probably didn't beep against a pinball machine.
You're like the worst. I had Robert Fury on a little bit ago, and he dropped an F-bomb, and I had to bleep that out.
That wasn't rape is a, I said it again. There it is.
Oh,
it's a thing that happens. It's a terrible, tragic.
There's a lot of things that happen that are swear words. Or let's just say not appropriate for the radio.
I'm just saying that on your show, when you have to do your accused retrospective, you're going to have a tough time talking about it.
Okay.
It's like talking about a zombie film without saying the word zombie.
Okay. All right, I guess I asked for it. Oh, that was a bad way to say it.
Oh, that was awful. I think that should be bleeped up.
No, but anyways, getting back to Tower Heist. That's going to be my segue out of anything inappropriate. Getting back to Tower Heist. It's a button pusher. It's a fun little movie. It's funny. Eddie Murphy actually does a great job in this movie, and you realize what talent he had when he wasn't kind of gaming for the children audience.
Mm-hmm.
And, he's funny, and Ben Stiller, for the most part, stays out of his Ben Stiller tropes that he keeps falling into.
Really?
Yeah. There's one scene where he kind of swerves into one, and it kind of is jarring because you're used to him doing what he does in movies like the Night of the Museum, where it just kind of rattles on and on and on.
Right.
You can see that the movie was a bit of a patchwork because it was originally written for Eddie Murphy and Martin Lawrence and a full black cast. And there's actually one or two lines in the beginning where they were very un-Ben Stiller-esque lines.
Mm-hmm.
And they're sort of, again, jarring. And then you realize, oh, that was probably written for Martin Lawrence and would have sounded perfect coming out of his mouth.
Yeah.
But you know what? It's an enjoyable film. It's funny. It has some great lines. It has some great moments. It has some great physical comedy and some decent action type moments.
You say all of this with an asterisk hiding in your voice.
No.
Like, there's just this tone that's somewhere behind there. It's not all good.
No, there's no but. It's a completely enjoyable movie. It's one of those movies that falls under the realm of, it's way better than it has any business being.
That's fair. I do have my only real question about it, because it just looks so average that I can't really get my ire up about it.
Yeah.
The one question I have is, how is Alan Alda? Because the guy's a genius, but casting Alan Alda as a bad guy is either inspired or completely moronic.
Well, I mean, you got the Mephisto waltz that he was the bad guy in. He was the Satan worshiper, and that was just silly. but he can play the rich jerk really, really well. And in fact, he looks the part, because he's actually gotten so old, like Franklin Jelly, he no longer looks like what he used to look like. He doesn't even look like an older version of what he used to look like. He doesn't look like Hawkeye Pierce. He looks like, some crappy lawyer from...
But he's still such a nice guy. Like, even his character in West Wing, where they initially tried to make him, kind of a mustache-twirling Republican, he created that role into a very well-rounded, universal, nuanced character who even if you disagreed with him politically, you saw this worth behind him. And I don't, is that what happens here, or no, is he more of a concrete villain? Like he's just plain old villain.
He has that warm fuzzy schmoozing nature to him that makes you think he's cool. But I actually think he lays it on well as being, you know, he's the guy who stole this money, and I think he does it well. And what's interesting about it is if you look at sort of like the political climate of the country with the whole Occupy Wall Street and that sort of thing. I don't know whether Brett Ratner looked into a crystal ball and knew that this was going to come out right, you know, kind of right on that crest of the Occupy movement wave, but he's going to benefit from that, I think, a lot. Obviously, this is a reflection of the bailout and the economy and that sort of thing. But it does a really interesting job because, first of all, they paid Ben Stiller $15 million to be in it. Eddie Murphy, $7.5 million. God knows what they paid Brett Ratner, probably at least 10 to direct it. So they're all super rich people playing the poor people trying to win money. But they frame it, or Ratner and the writers and everybody frame it in such a way, it's not anti-rich. It's anti-rich guy who steals money and swindles people.
Right.
So I think it was more successful than something like In Time, which was last week, where it was this, you know, rich versus poor, very strict on the black and white side. Whereas this one's like, well, it's if you're wealthy or not, but this guy, it's not that the people are trying to steal from a rich guy. They're trying to steal from a rich guy who stole from them.
Right. So it's a revenge heist.
Yeah. And I think that that's going to play better with an audience than just, you know, just a very black and white rich versus poor. This is good versus bad. So I think it actually it will benefit from just sort of like the national awareness of some of the political fallout that's happening in the country. But it actually does a good job, because it would be so hypocritical for them to be shame on you rich people. And Ben Stiller's walking away with $15 million. I mean, he's literally walking away with $5 million, with three quarters of what they're trying to steal from Alan Alda's character.
Nice.
So
he, like the joke's on everyone else, Ben Stiller stole that money, ultimately.
Well, he earned the money. So, I mean, he got paid. It's not, he didn't steal it from, you know, he didn't, like, take it from a government bailout. He's, you know, I mean, you've got Universal Picture giving it to him, so.
That's true. And whatever they want to give their money to, that's their decision, so.
Yeah, exactly. So, but I have to say, it kind of rocks. I have to say, it's a very enjoyable film.
I'm shocked.
Yeah, you should be. Wait till we talk about, let's talk about Harold and Kumar now. So, the next film is a very Harold and Kumar 3D Christmas. Harold and Kumar have a very 3D Christmas adventure. As they notice the line break was there. Very 3D Christmas adventure as they lead a search for a new Christmas tree in New York City.
Oh, that's pleasant.
I shot Santa Claus in the face. He's real, and I shot him in the face.
What the?
I don't know. Hasn't the whole 3D thing jumped the shark by now?
It's gonna be amazing!
Merry Christmas.
I hope you're still alive.
What are you talking about?
We saw you get shot.
In that whorehouse?
In Texas.
You branded a prostitute.
Remember?
You have to be more specific.
That's very sweet.
It is. Well, you know what's funny is, first of all, did you like the first Harold and Kumar movies?
I loved them.
You loved them both?
The first one I love unequivocally. Mm-hmm. The second one feels like such a, in my mind, had they made a sequel to Stripes, it would have been the same quality as the sequel to the original Harold and Kumar. And that sounds
probably
like...
Well, wait. In a Caddyshack 2 sort of way, or what? What do you...
Well, that's why I didn't want to use that reference, because Caddyshack 2, I think, is atrocious.
Okay.
But, like, Caddyshack 2, had they gotten more of the original people together for it? Because, you know, you do the same exact thing, and there's a quality there, and the same people are involved, and there's good minds, but it's never going to be as good. It just won't. Yeah. Like, you're using a tired premise, and... You know, in a way, I thought that Harold and Kumar would become the on the road to, like, you know, the Bing Crosby, Bob Hope pairing of our generation.
The doped up Bing Crosby, Bob Hope version.
Hey, Bing Crosby was pretty doped up. Okay, whiskey counts.
The doped up junk showing Bing Crosby, Bob Hope version.
Amen. Right. I'm happy with that.
Okay, well, you know, we're gonna go to a break, and then we'll finish talking about Harold and Kumar and a couple other things in the third segment, because we got to go to a break right now.
Miles of hard road, 33 years of tough luck, 44 skulls buried in the ground, crawling down through the muck. Oh yeah.
And welcome back to Fat Guys of the Movies. We are in the middle of talking about Harold and Kumar's very 3D Christmas. And basically just talking about whether or not you like the series. I like the first one. It's been a while since I've seen it, so it was on DVD at some point. So I really can't, I mean, I remember liking it, but I can't remember to what degree I liked it.
I feel like that bodes poorly, but
no, I mean it was funny, you know.
That's where, like, the first one I can remember almost all the scenes from it. The second one I can remember maybe one or two. Like, it's not as rememberable.
Yeah, well, the last one, the Guantanamo Bay one, had funny moments, but it did suffer a little bit from sequelitis in the sense that it was trying to recreate the magic from the first one, and said, okay, we have to have these beats and we have to have these characters in it. But they really didn't, it wasn't as cohesive. It felt sort of Porky's 2-ish.
Right. That, yeah. Sense. That may be an even better, sort of, correlatory. Yeah. Correlatory? May be an even better corollary. Sorry, lost my brain for a whole second there. But
I'll let you stand by that definition.
I was trying to remember scenes from the movie, and I just remembered the, like, no bottoms party, and I think that infected my brain really quick. But, you know, and speaking of which, though, what I do appreciate about the movie is whether the second one was funny or not, or rememberable or not, they get away with doing a lot of really interesting things. And it is very much, you can feel the comedy writers trying and testing and experimenting, and that's what is really that's what I really appreciate about it.
Yeah,
but well, the new one. But does the new one work? Did you like the new one?
I think. Well, let me say one more thing about the second one, and this is I think was my biggest complaint. And actually, you can dig through the old episodes of Fat Guys in the Movies and probably find one where Neil and I talked about this. It got, like, it was trying to make a political statement at the same time. You know, it was trying to make a statement about Guantanamo Bay and terrorists and treatment of them. And I'm just kind of like, oh, just be funny. Let's stop trying to, like, make a statement, because is Harold and Kumar the movie? Is a Harold and Kumar movie the vehicle you really want to use to make a statement? I mean, what credibility does that lend yourself? You know? And that was my beef with the first one, or the second one, that they were like, oh, well, let's try and say this wouldn't really. It's just a stupid pothead movie.
And now in the third one, they're trying to make a statement about Santa.
Yeah, and the third one, they don't do any sort of statement. They just said, we're just going to do offensive shit. And by the way, we're not on the radio for this segment. So you can talk about rape all you want, you know.
Finally.
Yes. But no, they have no pretense of trying to make a statement, of trying to say any sort of, there's no sort of message in there. It's just them saying, let's be offensive, let's be obnoxious, let's be funny, let's do things like put a baby on drugs,
like it,
and see if we can get away with it, you know. And these are things that are in the trailer, so you know, these aren't necessarily spoilers, you know. So I thought it was a funny movie. Again, like Tower Heist, it was way funnier than it ever should have been, you know. And what's funny, one thing that is interesting about the movie is they throw in the whole Wall Street protesting stuff in there.
Oh, really?
It almost feels like they did that as an afterthought.
Yeah, I imagine they must have.
Yeah, but I mean, it worked. And it's one of those, it was one of those timely, you know, let's do a quick reshoot type thing that I thought worked. And it's you know, it's a funny movie. There's offensive stuff, some crazy stuff. They push just far enough without getting too ridiculous. So yeah, I liked it. I thought it was a funny movie.
Well, I'm glad to hear it, because I love those sort of dumb movies, dumb comedy that maybe is a little smarter than it needs to be. But those two guys, I think they have a lot of chemistry together, and I love the idea that they've broken out beyond the stoner film to create something different. And now they're on a third movie, and it's definitely different.
So. It's definitely still a stoner film, though. I will tell you that. There's also it goes without saying, Neil Patrick Harris,
mm-hmm.
fucking awesome in this
yeah,
movie.
Yeah, I imagine he steals the entire show.
Even better than the other movies, as I remember, he is freaking hilarious in this film.
Nice.
So yeah, definitely that's the highlight of the movie.
So it kind of rocks.
No, it totally rocks. This one's totally rocks. Yeah, yeah. So, again, and I actually put this on Twitter tonight. I'm like, this is a great weekend for movies. It shouldn't be, but it is. So, and now your favorite segment, because I remember the last time you were on the show, you scoffed and turned your nose up at this, predicting box office winners. First of all, let's talk about who won last weekend. And it was, you know what, I don't have the box office pulled up. That is how prepared we are on this show. I don't even put that in the show notes. Usually I remember.
I think it was Paranormal Activity, right? The third?
Was it? Hold on. Let me just double check. I do not want to. I don't want to sound less professional. No, it was Puss in Boots. Puss in Boots won the weekend.
Right. That's what I said. Puss in Boots 3.
Puss in Boots 3 with the
Paranormal Activity boots.
Paranormal pusses. But yeah, it
I actually think I rented that movie one time.
Yeah. And with an enema bag full of drugs, right?
Full of drugs.
Yeah. But Puss in Boots came out, did $34 million, which is the lowest DreamWorks movie since Flushed Away. But then again, it's opening Halloween weekend. This was a weird weekend, and I even said this when I reviewed it. It's very apparent when you see the movie why it came out on October 28th and not like November 4th.
Because they weren't trying to make it a Best Picture nominee.
No, so. I don't think they were expecting it. It wasn't a big holiday tentpole.
Right, but I mean, I think that the only gripe that I have about that stuff is that Halloween weekend going into a Monday Halloween should have horror films. That's what should be at the box office. Lots of them, and like 30. 30 horror films need to be released in October every year.
Brand new horror films in the theaters. That's
Get
right.
on it.
Well, there was In Time, which came in third at $12 million. Paranormal Activity did $18 million. And then it was Footloose and then The Rum Diary at $5 million. And then way down at the bottom, just a hair over $1 million, somewhere in like the 13th or 14th place, was Anonymous. Not a mouse.
Not a mouse.
What's interesting is, I don't know if anyone who knows me knows that I think Nikki Fink has like fantastic numbers, but she's an idiot.
How so do you mean?
Well, her analysis is terrible. It's the same thing with Brandon Gray. It's the same thing with the only one who's got a decent analysis was Paula Darren Bangerbagadagadangadangadong, the guy from, I think it was Box Office Magazine.
The guy from offensiveracism.com.
He's not Asian, I don't think.
Yeah, I don't know, man. Like, I scoffed at this segment last time because I don't know this stuff. I can't count, so it makes this all the harder for me. And yeah, I don't know. I think there's a passing interest in box office stuff, certainly, but as far as like caring about it, I can't work up any sort of soda in me to care about any of this. I could give a shit whether a movie makes money or not, unless it's a movie that is a like indie film. Or something that's
discovered and kind of gets
needs a little love and gets a push forward and actually succeeds at it. That impresses me. But when Puss in Boots makes $34 million, I'm like, well, that's what they wanted to make and they made it. So there you go. Yeah. Shocking.
The reason I was going to say Nikki Fink's an idiot is because she said she said that it would have a huge Monday because Monday was Halloween and that's the big. It made $2.5 million on Monday, which is actually $300,000 less than it made the previous Monday.
Yeah, that makes sense.
It was not a huge... Halloween just wasn't a huge day for movies.
Well, it's also a Monday. No matter how you slice it, it's a Monday. And that's... You know, the other thing is a movie like Paranormal Activity 3 especially is a water cooler film. So you see it the first weekend or you don't. Like, that's just how it works. So
it's front-loaded. It definitely is.
But speaking of which, what do you think is going to take the box office this weekend?
I want to know what you think is going to win the box office because this is I want to hear you. Like, is The Rum Diary going to come from behind and make $80 million?
I think that there's actually a re-release of The Accused that's going to make $30 million and take the top.
That's going to be 30 rapings against the pinball machine.
That's it. That's my guess, and I'm sticking with it.
Tower Heist is going to win the weekend, definitely. It's going to win the weekend probably with about 30 or 40 million, maybe.
You really think it's going to make $30 or $40 million?
Yeah, Oh yeah. You know, and here's why. It's one of those, it has a wide appeal. First of all, it's PG-13. It's got a lot of recognizable names that tend to be brought box office draws. It's got a multiracial cast, so it's going to draw the people who like sort of the mainstream audience, but it's also going to go for Eddie Murphy. Eddie Murphy, I think, is going to bring in a lot of the black audience. There's also going to be the fact that
I think Ben Stiller will bring in a lot of the black audience too.
Well, you know, he is sort of the white
black. And guy. I think Gabourey Sidibe will bring in a lot of the Jewish
or the Jamaicans.
She plays
a Jamaican
and the white.
I have to ask friend of the show Andrew Robinson, who's originally from Jamaica, Kingston, Jamaica, because I want him to see it. I want to find out if her Jamaican accent is any good.
I would bet dollars to donuts that it is not.
It's probably awful. Anyways, let's Rasta, move on, man. To yeah,
ja,
yeah, man. Let's move on to the listener feedback. We have one from Fozzie Bear. He's schooling us about the Empty Nest spinoff. We did spinoffs as our Fat Guy 5 last week, and Jim Napier and I came up. We had to go to TV, and I mentioned Empty Nest. Now, Fozzie, bless his heart, he just emailed. He said, "Dearest Kevin and guest." So, Jim, sorry, you didn't even register a name. He didn't even look it up on the website. He just said, "Ed guest." Or maybe he's talking to you because you're the current guest. He gives a lengthy explanation of the Empty Nest Golden Girl spinoff, which I will post on the page if you want to go check it out. Basically pointing out that there was supposed to be a doctor, and then he was supposed to get together with his wife, but then they retooled it when they actually did the show, and they killed his wife and put a lesbian in the house. I don't know. Was she a lesbian in the show? Or is this just Fozzie?
Wait, who was a lesbian?
The one that wasn't Christy McNichol.
Oh, I have no idea. I didn't look up her skirt or anything.
What? Really? Yeah. Are they tattooed when they make that decision?
They're all stamped.
Oh, okay. That's good to know. I'll keep that in mind. I'll check that out next time I go to the haunted whorehouse that you're talking about.
That's actually, what I just said is incorrect information. So.
It's not scientifically accurate.
So it probably won't work out for you if you check it.
You're supposed to be a doctor. Anyways, we also have a listener feedback from Ty from St. Louis, who just did. They won the World Series, didn't they?
You're barking up the wrong tree, man. Box office predictions in baseball.
He signs a Ty 10 from STL, which I'm assuming is St. Louis. But he said they won the World Series.
Or St. Lothario, Mexico.
It's possible. Anyways, he goes, you've probably gotten a ton of these, but just in case, how could you not mention The Simpsons, which is a spinoff from the Tracy Ullman show?
That's true.
Thanks for saying that. He's absolutely correct. What's interesting is Tracy Ullman, I think at one point, tried to sue The Simpsons because she was basically saying, "I gave him the start."
Was that true?
I think that, well, I don't know if there was actual legal action taken, but there was some bad blood there because she was saying she should get something from The Simpsons.
See, I think that's funny, though. I mean, I don't know what conversation, how deep it went, but I know that when you're talking about spinoffs, you typically think about something like a character mm-hmm. being involved in a show, like, you know, Mary Tyler Moore is going to spin mm-hmm. off into Rhoda. And or that's Luke a character from one show into another one. But something like Tracy Ullman's show, it wasn't like The Simpsons were a character on her show. They were a cartoon that played during the sketch show.
Yeah.
So it's kind of non-traditional that way in when we're thinking about traditional spinoffs. So that's my two cents.
I think she was just mad because The Simpsons, even way back when this story broke, The Simpsons was on the air way longer than any of her shows ever.
That's true. That's a tough call, which is unfortunate because I am actually a big Tracy Ullman fan. I think she's really funny. So
yeah, she's funny. I'm not wild about her, but that's okay.
But you like Brett Ratner, so.
I do like Brett Ratner, but you know, if she was in that Brett Ratner movie, I'd watch the hell out of that thing.
With Eddie Murphy as himself in a fat suit.
Oh, yes, absolutely. Well, fat suit we can put away. Speaking of Eddie Murphy, here's a good segue.
And fat suits.
And fat suits. Let's talk. We got a Fat Guy 5 coming up. Isn't this awesome?
I love it.
Oh, great. It is the 5 great Eddie Murphy movies. You will notice that most of these, there's something in common.
See if you can spot it.
See if you can spot it. So you want to do the first one since you definitely agree with that one, and I'll do the next two.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I agree with all of them. But okay. And one, I might say that this is an inspired list because we were going through what we wanted to do, and this was like the 18th idea that we came up with, and it finally clicked that we really did need to celebrate and maybe inform some of the listeners that are only 30 years old or less that Eddie Murphy was at one time a viable comedic star.
He was at one time the highest paid performer, I think, at one time.
I would not doubt that. But the first film that we're going to be looking at is Trading Places, which is an absolute gem of a comedy. It would be his funniest film, if not for one other entry on this list that I will contend is a bit funnier. But of course, Trading Places has the very simple premise of a destitute homeless man, played by Eddie Murphy, trading places with an incredibly wealthy person. And the idea is to follow both of them to get those experiences, and it in a way fit perfectly in with the 1980s, and in a way also fits in perfectly right now. So I love it. It's a fantastic, wonderful comedy. Eddie Murphy brings a delightful ruggishness to it's kind of a crass.
He brings the quarter blood technique too.
Yeah, he does. Everything about his comedy in this film is covered with like a moldy banana peel, and it works brilliantly. I mean, you can see why he is so treasured as a comic.
Oh, he was also, I believe when he shot this, he was still on Saturday Night Live.
That may be the case. It would have been right around the same time. So I wouldn't be surprised if he was still on there getting mistreated over at Saturday Night Live.
This, along with the next one on the list, which is 48 Hours, which is less of a comedy but more of a buddy cop film.
Mm-hmm.
But it definitely has Eddie Murphy as the comedian to it, which is, in fact, Brett Ratner, when he did the Rush Hour series, said this was part of what inspired him in making the Chris Tucker character, even though Eddie Murphy was a criminal.
Wow, I don't see that at all. But that's it. Well, there you go, I guess. Nick Nolte actually inspired me in a lot of ways. What?
Take heroin?
No, to get my air conditioning theory PhD.
Oh, well, that's awesome.
It's true.
Does he have a PhD in air conditioning?
Probably. The guy's a badass, so he probably has PhDs in like 50 things and speaks 18 languages.
PhDs in heroin.
Dude, do you know that Nick Nolte in his voice can just say whatever he wants and everyone can understand him?
You can just talk like this all the time.
Yeah, everyone. All languages. He's a human babblefish. It's a true story.
I think he's absolutely right. But yeah, 48 Hours, I think, was actually the first. I believe this came before Trading Places. It was his first big. It was his first Hollywood movie.
Right. It was kind of an introduction for him. And of course, they made another 48 Hours.
Which I liked, actually.
No, it's good. Another 48 Hours is one of the rare, great sequels. I think it's arguably better than the first. And I will go out on a limb and defend that position.
Right up there with the Stripes sequel that never happened.
That I would love that if that happened. But I got to say that 48 Hours actually seems a lot like the next entry on the list, and that's Beverly Hills Cop, which may be the most iconic Eddie Murphy film. Yeah. Simply because he sunk into the Axel Foley role. The theme song was a big hit and was, you know, very earwiggish. And it was just such a badass comedy. Judge Reinhold even looked cool in it. How do you do that? How do you pull that off?
It's amazing.
And ultimately, I don't think we need to speak a lot about it because everyone knows how good it is. But it was this wonderful, irreverent, you know, police work being done. A guy from Detroit headed out to Beverly Hills, taking a rough and tumble view of everything, a fly by the seat of his pants. And he basically just did whatever he wanted to do, and murders got solved. And what I loved about it is, you know, you watch something like Lethal Weapon, and Beverly Hills Cop is effectively Lethal Weapon, where one dude is carrying both parts.
Yeah. He does a fantastic job. You're right. He does carry it. I mean, he's got the sidekicks with Taggart and, it was Judd Reinhold's character. I forget his name. But he did have, he carried both parts. He carried the buddy cop in one role.
Yeah. They became set dressing to him. So. But that's three movies down, and the next one is...
Can I show one other interesting Tower Heist Brett Ratner reference?
Oh, God.
This?
I hope not.
In Tower Heist, Ben Stiller, because we know, again, you know this from the trailer, Ben Stiller picks up Eddie Murphy's character from jail, and he shows up in a Chevy Nova. It's not a crappy blue Chevy Nova, because now Chevy Novas are considered cool muscle cars, which is bullshit, because my parents had them in the 70s, and they were shit cars.
So all of a sudden, I like that, because I feel like it takes someone like you to really spot that.
Yeah.
So
thank you. I don't know if that was a compliment or not.
No, it is. Absolutely. It's one of those things where, like, you embed yourself in movies and you can say, like, oh, there's a really a quick, easy nod, and I recognize it. A lot of people can't. Like me, I would never have noticed that. So
thank you.
But speaking of never noticing things, the fourth film on the list is what I would argue is not only the funniest Eddie Murphy movie, but maybe the second funniest film ever made.
Mm. Oh, wow.
Yeah, that's right.
What is the funniest film then?
Blazing Saddles.
Okay, I'll give you that, definitely. Go on. Coming to America?
Coming to America, The Royal Penis is Clean. Such a ridiculous movie. A prince in Africa decides that he doesn't want to get married to a beautiful but vacant woman who he is betrothed to. He doesn't know her. He wants to fall in love, not have an arranged marriage. And so he picks what better place to find a royal woman than Queens. And so he heads there. And, you know, this incredibly wealthy, just wealthy beyond measure. We're not even talking about, you know, someone who owns a large company. We're talking about a dude who is prince to a country. And he goes and makes himself poor with his manservant, played by Arsenio Hall, who, he's not very happy about being poor, but they work at McDowell's, which is the copyright infringing sidestep that they get away with. And, you know, he falls in love with the boss's daughter, and they get to know each other on a real human level. And the wacky situation of the lie that they're telling, which is that he is poor and not fabulously rich, creates so many mazes of confusion and different, like, you know, the father warming up to who he thinks is rich and then realizing someone else is rich, and then the sister warming up to someone who's rich and everyone else who's rich. You see these ideas, and it plays out human stereotypes against themselves in a very funny way. And I think it's a potent kind of social political commentary on the way that we treat other people, but it's also just every minute of that movie is hilarious. So, Sexual Chocolate. I just dropped the mic.
What I also think is interesting about it is it's sort of like The Golden Child, which is another Eddie Murphy movie he did, which was sort of a mixed genre type thing, is he managed to bill it as an Eddie Murphy sort of comedy moments, but he did this with he was able to do this Beverly Hills Cop. He could do the funny, but he also fit the genre. He could do the cop film, he could do sort of the supernatural genre with Golden Child. And Coming to America, he did basically a romantic comedy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's
out
right.
Of that. Yeah, I mean, he didn't do it. Was that John Landis who directed that one, too? Because mm-hmm. he also directed Trading Places.
Yeah, and it was the kind of thing where it was a romantic comedy, but it focused on the man completely. So it wasn't the kind of thing where you got, you know, both characters equal measure the way that Sleepless in Seattle or You've Got Mail started to do with a romantic comedy genre. It was, you know, this is really from his perspective, and we don't really get to know Lisa at all. unless it's through his eyes, so.
Yeah. One other thing I want to—it's an interesting Coming to America reference. I had a friend in high school. His name was Shaw, and he was Pakistani, and he's American, but his father was from Pakistan, and he'd go back there and visit. And they didn't live in a great area or anything like that, but they would still do arranged marriages. I think I know they still do that in India. I don't know if I'm assuming they continue to do that in Pakistan. Mm-hmm. And his father had arranged one for him, and he's like, I'm not doing this. And he's like, no. And we're talking to him about it. And Shaw was a bit of a player back in the States. You know, he had a lot of girls going for him. And I asked him, what was she like? He's like, oh no, she was pretty, but it was just like Coming to America, where you could ask her to hop on one foot and bark like a dog.
Oh no, that's great. I mean, I mean, in a way, it's just like, how do you turn that down? But then you think, oh well, never mind. It's like the Twilight Zone episode. Where you're just like, this is perfect, and then you realize it's actually hell. You're not in heaven.
Mr. Pip. Yeah, well, yeah, it would be. It'd be fun for a weekend.
Yeah, Mr. Pip is arranging your marriage. But and now, I don't know if you agree with this last choice, but I want to throw it in there because hopefully everyone's caught the DNA that holds all of these other four films together, and that is that they all came out like 40, 50 years ago.
Well, they all came out. I think they all came out within like 6 years of each other,
and they were all in the 80s. So, So we wanted to choose another one. Just Shrek is an obvious choice because it is such a big, you know, film. Eddie Murphy is not necessarily the front and center star of it, but he does. he does nail a role. And the same goes for this movie, but it is just a completely different film from the ones we've chosen. That's Dreamgirls, which earned Eddie Murphy a Best Supporting Actor Oscar nomination. And I agree with it completely. His portrayal there is gripping, wonderful, very tortured, and the movie itself is overall just a fantastic, you know, a fantastic, wonderful movie with a lot of great music in it, which I'm a sucker for. So,
yeah, it's good. I just I thought the movie ran too long, like a lot of films during award season.
Sure.
So that was my big complaint, but I thought he did fantastic, and then he followed it up with Norbit.
And that's right. That was the whole thing at that time. People were suspecting that since Norbit came out in like December, that it completely soured his chances of getting a Best Supporting Actor for Dreamgirls because the Academy was disappointed in him making such a terrible, vomit of a movie.
Yeah, exactly. Let's do an honorable mention and get out of here. I'm just going to give an honorable mention for another movie that was in recent years.
Vampires in Brooklyn.
Actually, Vampire in Brooklyn was not a bad movie, directed by Wes Craven.
I liked it. It was good.
It was good. That was at a time where he was actually doing some decent films that just weren't getting nobody was seeing him. No, this one was Shrek. and Shrek, and I'll put Shrek and Shrek 2 on this. Screw the other two movies because they weren't that good. But the first two were good movies, and it was him doing an animated voice. This is before he kind of fell down into that ugly Serbian film-ish rabbit hole of trying to do kids' movies and then just raping them.
But happily, he's come out recently and said that he has no interest in kids' movies anymore.
Yeah,
and that
he's not getting them laid anymore.
Well, and he wants to enjoy his wealth and be a little bit more discerning with the projects that he picks, and that he can take on some edgier material, and if that doesn't work, then he's going to go do stand-up again, which, yeah, why not? So,
or he's just going to run around Las Vegas with Michael Jordan and scare old women in elevators.
I like it. But otherwise, the bottom line is that there was a time when Eddie Murphy was cranking out not just quality material, but some of the best films of that decade.
Absolutely.
So,
with that, we better go to a break.
Let's do it. I'm ready.
And welcome back to Fat Guys in the Movies. We are in the last segment, finishing you up here. We just got done with the Fat Guy 5, talking about Eddie Murphy, and we did a little more talk about Harold and Kumar and did some box office predictions and got some listener feedback. It was actually a very cogent and relevant segment. I don't know what you did to the show, but you may have broken it.
I actually drank an entire bottle of Robitussin before that.
Ooh, that's awesome.
Yeah, it'll set me straight.
Woohoo! So let's see. What's coming up next year?
I'm pretty sure it's the world famous A DVD Roundup.
There we are.
I like it.
Film sound effect.
What are we rounding up?
We're rounding up DVDs. I'm just going to rip through the ones that I've got because I know you've got a couple that are a little more different. These are the very mainstream ones that I'll do, but I want to hear a little bit about what you want to say. But let's get through these first. The ones that I have to pick, Cars 2. I know a lot of people did not – a lot of critics were hard on the movie. I thought it was perfectly charming and enjoyable. The original Cars wasn't my favorite. So,
but your this kids was liked kinda, it.
Oh, kids! Of course, kids like anything like that. But I enjoyed Cars 2. And part of it is I'm not a hater of Larry the Cable Guy. So I say check it out. It's on DVD and Blu-ray and 3D Blu-ray. And speaking of 3D Blu-ray, they got all three Toy Story movies in 3D. If you have your 3D television, you can get those. There's also Water for Elephants, which isn't great. It would have been better if you didn't have Robert Pattinson in it.
I thought he was appropriately broody.
Well, my problem with Robert Pattinson, he has this constant look of like he's ready to throw up.
I was actually going to say, like, it looks like he's about to have a bowel movement.
Well, see, I have different people. Like, I think he has that look of ready to throw up. I always thought Josh Hartnett looked like he was constipated.
Yeah.
In anything he does. And then Gina Gershon always looks like she's smelling somebody's fart.
See, I thought Josh...
But in a sexy way.
We'll talk about Josh Hartnett in a second, actually, but I always thought that he looked like he was working out a really complex math problem in his head.
He's just really confused. So. Like, wait a minute. Like 3 + 3.
Okay, well then.
There's also Crazy Stupid Love, which I was not a big fan of, but it is out this week. And then also for those who are looking for a little bit more of the, I guess, artistic fair, you can go to Snowflower and The Secret Fan, which is Wayne Wang's new movie about Chinese heritage, sort of spanning generations.
And I have not seen it, but I have seen the production work on it, and it looks absolutely gorgeous. So
yeah, but both that and Water for Elephants are very beautifully shot movies.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. So I have a few picks as well, and I fear that I'm going to come off as like an indie film mainstream hater in this entire show, but I
That's
do,
the way you are.
I do like mainstream movies a lot, but, this week on DVD, Bunraku is one that we caught at Fantastic Fest a couple of years ago. Very good movie. It is, very good. Let's put it this way. It is a very kinetic, crazy, over the top, stylized, like just saturatedly stylized, samurai neo future movie where there are no handguns anymore and everyone has gone back to fighting with swords. Josh Hartnett stars in it. He is doing complex math the entire time.
broke my brain with that last statement.
And Ron Perlman, I just have to say, Ron Perlman is, he elevates every single movie that he's in, and here it is no different, playing a gigantic dreadlocked villain he's amazing. And the movie is not for everyone. It's a bit crazy. There is more than a few problems with it, but it is such a fun movie that it is definitely worth a watch. And the other two films that are out on DVD that I want to give a chance to, Tabloid, the new documentary from Errol Morris about a possible Mormon kidnapping in England with a crazed woman, or maybe she was just rescuing her love. Who knows the real truth? Maybe Errol Morris. I have not seen it, but Errol Morris has made zero bad movies, so I'm into it. And on the documentary front,
just like Brett Ratner, by the way.
Yeah, right. Errol Morris has made zero good movies. He's made all amazing, wonderful documentaries. So, but in the documentary front, there's also HBO Films put out Hot Coffee this summer, which tells the story of one, the woman who spilled a hot coffee on herself at McDonald's and sued, and everyone kind of made that the butt of a joke. The reality is that their coffee was 190 degrees and it gave her third degree burns in her crotch. And since then, the lawsuit was successful. She actually got them to lower their temperature. There had been over 700 complaints before her. There's a lot more to the story, and it is one of the kind of documentary that makes you realize that you've been spun and made to believe something, that a large group of corporations got together and created a new narrative for it, made the woman the butt of the joke instead of their policies. And it is kind of the documentary that opened your eyes to a lot of things and will probably enrage you in several of them. So,
was she the butt of the jokes or the crotch of the jokes?
Oh, that's good. She was the crotch and the butt. We're talking about trees.
All right. This week's stinker is, I'm with a caveat, I have not seen this yet because I didn't request it.
But no one has.
And this is exactly why. Trespass is a new movie directed by Joel Schumacher, starring Nicolas Cage and Nicole Kidman, two Oscar winners, in a movie that made like $2,000 in limited release and is now out on Blu-ray and DVD. Joel Schumacher's last, this is follow-up to 12.
And it's been two trashed films in a row for him.
It cannot be any good. So I just there's no way. And, and when you see two big Oscar stars going direct to video, pretty much direct to video, it opened barely. It's pretty much direct to video. You know, it's a bad thing.
It's a rough deal.
Let's do the review wrap up. Tower Heist gets a Kinda Rocks from me, and a very Harold and Kumar 3D Christmas gets a Totally Rocks from me. Next week we've got The Immortals, Jack and Jill, which we have a screener for, believe it or not, and J. Edgar. Got 20 seconds. Say goodbye, Scott, say goodbye, Cole, and let us know where we can find you.
You can find me, of course, at Film School Rejects, writing a bunch of stuff and editing a bunch of stuff. And I also host Reject Radio, our weekly podcast where we interview filmmakers and let them tell their stories. And that is every Wednesday we update that. So thanks for having me on, Kevin. I really have fun doing this.
Thank you so much for being on, and we'll see you guys next week.
Scooby-Doo wow. Tower Heist.
What was that? Was that your Judd Hirsch impression?
And that was really unintentional Judd Hirsch impression. Because I was capping off your synopsis.
Okay.
Tower Heist.
Represent.
Brett Ratner. Like that.
That's hilarious.
Brett Ratner is not hilarious.
I like Brett. He's one of those people. He's like, he's one of those directors that I'm like, he makes absolute shit, but it's fun.
The problem with Brett Ratner is this. is that he is completely averagely crappy. Like, everyone thinks, oh, but he's a name synonymous with bad taste. But
not,
I could probably think
bad.
Of, I mean, I can probably think of 20 directors far worse than Brett Ratner. Yeah. He's just so in the middle that he's recognizable. But you don't know a lot of. I mean, quick, name the director of Leap Year right now. You can't.
Alexander Payne, no.
But it's a way worse director than Brett Ratner, I will tell you that. Even Gary Marshall has morphed into a worse director than Brett Ratner. So I'll leave it.